The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. A throng of bearded men, in sad-colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats, intermixed with women, some wearing hoods and others bareheaded, was assembled in front of a wooden edifice, the door of which was heavily timbered with oak and studded with iron spikes. The founders of a new colony, whatever utopia of human virtue and happiness they might originally project, have invariably recognized it among their earliest practical necessities to allot a portion of the virgin soil as a cemetery, and another portion as the site of a prison. Before this ugly edifice was a grass plot, much overgrown with unsightly vegetation. But on one side of the portal was a wild rosebush, covered in this month of June with its delicate gems. The grass plot before the jail, in Prison Lane on a certain summer morning not less than 2 centuries ago, was also occupied by a pretty large number of the inhabitants of Boston, all with their eyes intently fastened on the iron-clamped oaken door. There was a solemnity of demeanor on the part of the spectators, as befitted a people amongst whom religion and law were almost identical. It was a circumstance to be noted on the summer morning when our story begins its course, that the women, of whom there were several in the crowd, appeared to take a peculiar interest in whatever penal infliction might be expected to ensue.
"Good wives," said a hard-featured dame of 50, "I'll tell you a piece of my mind. We women should have the handling of such malefactresses as this Hester Prynne. If the hussy stood up for judgment before us five, would she have come off with such a sentence as the worshipful magistrates have awarded?" "The magistrates are God-fearing gentlemen, but merciful overmuch. That is a truth," added another matron. "At the very least, they should have put the brand of a hot iron on Hester Prynne's forehead. Madam Hester would have winced at that, I warrant. But little will she care what they put on the bodice of her gown."
"Hush now," exclaimed a man in the crowd, "for the lock is turning in the prison door, and here comes Mistress Prynne herself."
The door of the jail being flung open from within, there appeared in the first place, like a black shadow emerging into the sunshine, the grim and grisly presence of the town beadle. Stretching forth the official staff in his left hand, he laid his right upon the shoulder of a young woman whom he drew forward, until on the threshold of the prison door she repelled him by an action marked with natural dignity and force of character, and stepped into the open air as if by her own free will. She bore in her arms a child, a baby of some 3 months old, who winked and turned aside its little face from the too vivid light of the day, because its existence heretofore had brought it acquainted only with the gray twilight of a dungeon. When the young woman, the mother of this child, stood fully revealed before the crowd, it seemed to be her first impulse to clasp the infant closely to her bosom. In a moment, however, widely judging that one token of her shame would but poorly serve to hide another, she took the baby on her arm, and, with a glance that would not be abashed, looked around at her townspeople and neighbors. On the breast of her gown, in fine red cloth, surrounded with an elaborate embroidery and fantastic flourishes of gold thread, appeared the letter A. The young woman was tall, with a figure of perfect elegance. She had dark and abundant hair, and a face which, besides being beautiful from regularity of feature, had the impressiveness belonging to marked brow and deep black eyes. But the point which drew all eyes and, as it were, transfigured the wearer was that scarlet letter. It had the effect of a spell. The grim beadle now made a gesture with his staff.
"Make way, good people! Make way in the king's name! Open a passage, and I promise ye, Mistress Prynne shall be set where man, woman, and child may have a fair sight of her brave apparel. A blessing on the righteous colony of the Massachusetts, where iniquity is dragged out into the sunshine. Come along, Madam Hester, and show your scarlet letter in the marketplace.
Preceded by the beadle, Hester Prynne set forth and came to a sort of scaffold at the western extremity of the marketplace. In fact, this scaffold constitutes a portion of a penal machine, which was held in the old time to be as effectual an agent in the promotion of good citizenship as ever was the guillotine among the terrorists of France. It was, in short, the platform of the pillory. Hester ascended a flight of wooden steps and was thus displayed to the surrounding multitude at the height of a man's shoulders. The witnesses of Hester Prynne's disgrace were stern. Even had there been a disposition to turn the matter into ridicule, it must have been repressed and overpowered by the solemn presence of men no less dignified than the governor and several of his counselors, a judge, a general, and the ministers of the town, all of whom sat or stood in a balcony of the meeting house looking down upon the platform. Accordingly, the crowd was somber and grave. The unhappy culprit sustained herself, as best a woman might, under the heavy weight of 1,000 unrelenting eyes. Standing on that miserable eminence, she saw again her native village in Old England and her paternal home. She saw her father's face, with its bald brow and reverend white beard that flowed over the old-fashioned Elizabethan ruff. Her mother's, too, with the look of heedful and anxious love which it always wore in her remembrance. She saw her own face, glowing with girlish beauty and illuminating all the interior of the dusky mirror in which she had been wont to gaze at it. There she beheld another countenance, a pale, thin, scholar-like visage, with eyes that had a strange, penetrating power when it was their owner's purpose to read the human soul. This figure of the study and the cloister, as Hester Prynne's womanly fancy failed not to recall, was slightly deformed, with the left shoulder a trifle higher than the right. Next rose before her, in memory's picture gallery, the intricate and narrow thoroughfares, the huge cathedrals, a continental city, where a new life had awaited her, still in connection with the misshapen scholar. Lastly, in lieu of these shifting scenes, came back the rude marketplace of the Puritan settlement, with all the townspeople assembled and leveling their stern regards at Hester Prynne. Yes, at herself, who stood on the scaffold of the pillory, an infant on her arm, and the letter A in scarlet fantastically embroidered with gold thread upon her bosom. From this intense consciousness of being the object of severe and universal observation, the wearer of the scarlet letter was at length relieved by discerning on the outskirts of the crowd a figure which irresistibly took possession of her thoughts. An Indian in his native garb was standing there, but the red men were not so infrequent visitors of the English settlement that one of them would have attracted any notice from Hester Prynne. But by the Indian's side, and evidently sustaining a companionship with him, stood a white man, clad in a strange disarray of civilized and savage costume. He was small in stature, with a furrowed visage. Although by a seemingly careless arrangement of his garb he had endeavored to conceal or abate the peculiarity, it was sufficiently evident to Hester Prynne that one of this man's shoulders rose higher than the other. When he found the eyes of Hester Prynne fastened on his own and saw that she appeared to recognize him, he slowly and calmly raised his finger, made a gesture with it in the air, and laid it on his lips. Then he touched the shoulder of a townsman who stood next to him.
"I pray you, good sir, who is this woman, and wherefore is she here set up to public shame?"
"You must needs be a stranger in this region,"
answered the townsman,
"else you would surely have heard of Mistress Hester Prynne and her evil doings. She hath raised a great scandal, I promise you, in godly Master Dimmesdale's church.
Yonder woman, sir, was the wife of a certain learned man, English by birth, but who had long dwelt in Amsterdam, whence, some good time agone, he was minded to cross over and cast in his lot with us of the Massachusetts. To this purpose he sent his wife before him, remaining himself to look after some necessary affairs. In some 2 years or less that the woman has been a dweller here in Boston, no tidings have come of this learned gentleman. His young wife being left to her own misguidance.
Ah, aha! I conceive you, said the stranger.
So learned a man as you speak of should have learned this too in his books. And who, by your favor, sir, may be the father of yonder babe, which Mistress Prynne is holding in her arms? Of a truth, friend, that matter remaineth a riddle. Madam Hester absolutely refuses to speak, and the magistrates have laid their heads together in vain.
The learned man, observed the stranger, should come himself to look into the mystery. It irks me that the partner of her iniquity should not at least stand on the scaffold by her side. But he will be known. He will be known.
While this passed, Hester Prynne had been standing on her pedestal, still with a fixed gaze towards the stranger, so fixed a gaze that at moments of intense absorption all other objects in the visible world seemed to vanish, leaving only him and her. Dreadful as it was, she was conscious of a shelter in the presence of these thousand witnesses. It was better to stand thus with so many betwixt him and her than to greet him face to face, they two alone. Involved in these thoughts, she scarcely heard a voice behind her until it had repeated her name more than once, in a loud and solemn tone, audible to the whole multitude.
"Hearken unto me, Hester Prynne," said the voice.
Directly over the platform on which Hester Prynne stood was a kind of balcony appended to the meeting house. It was the place whence proclamations were wont to be made, with all the ceremonial that attended such public observances in those days. Here sat Governor Bellingham himself, with four sergeants about his chair bearing halberds, as a guard of honor. The other eminent characters by whom the chief ruler was surrounded were distinguished by a dignity of mien belonging to a period when the forms of authority were felt to possess the sacredness of divine institutions. The voice which had called her attention was that of the Reverend and famous John Wilson, the eldest clergyman of Boston, a great scholar, like most of his contemporaries in the profession, and withal a man of kind and genial spirit. This last attribute, however, had been less carefully developed than his intellectual gifts, and was, in truth, rather a matter of shame than self-congratulation with him.
"Hester Prynne," said the clergyman, "I have striven with my young brother here, under whose preaching of the word you have been privileged to sit."
Here Mr. Wilson laid his hand on the shoulder of a pale young man beside him.
"I have sought, I say, to persuade this godly youth that he should deal with you here in the face of heaven and before these wise and upright rulers and in hearing of all the people as touching the vileness and blackness of your sin. Knowing your natural temper better than I, he could the better judge what arguments to use that you should no longer hide the name of him who tempted you to this grievous fall. But he opposes to me that it were wronging the very nature of woman to force her to lay open her heart's secrets in such broad daylight and in presence of so great a multitude. Truly, as I sought to convince him, the shame lay in the commission of the sin, and not in the showing of it forth. What say you to it once again, Brother Dimmesdale? Must it be thou or I that shall deal with this poor sinner's soul?